Criminal Law, Professor Strong, on November 25th. Consideration of the choice of evils defense, also known as the necessity defense, as a cross-cutting justification. It provides a defense even if you meet all the elements of a particular crime. And we saw that although there's some variation in its formulation, in a typical jurisdiction, you have a cross-cutting justification defense. Necessity or choice of evils, if you're without blame in bringing about the situation, you reasonably believe that the conduct that you're undertaking is necessary to avoid an imminent harm that is greater than the harm of the conduct itself. And we saw last time that the defense has been found applicable even in prison escape cases, where it's particularly troublesome for a few reasons. And we saw, perhaps for those reasons, that even though in Unger the justification of choice of evils or necessity was permitted, and they said that the defendant should have gotten an instruction, in some jurisdictions, engraft special additional restrictions in this particular setting, when you're dealing with a prison breach kind of case. Why would they do that? And what have they done? We saw in California, for example, they cite the Lover Camp case in the Unger decision itself. Federal standards are a little different. The Supreme Court has taken a look at it for federal cases. Why would you engraft special additional requirements in this setting, when you don't in other settings in general, and what kind of special additional restrictions might you add in? Yes, sir?
Well, the reason why is because they sort of aren't involved in the situation because they are in prison for previous crimes.
Even though it might not be, you know, if you narrow your vision to exactly the situation they're facing, but if you broaden it a little bit, maybe they have a little bit of fault in landing themselves in this dangerous setting. And
yeah, and also, it may not be a lesser evil to allow criminals to roam free in the streets.
There are substantial dangers associated with that, and they're criminals. We don't really trust them quite as much, and so they may think that they can falsely employ this defense as a defense to prison breach when it's not appropriate, and maybe there's a little resistance to the idea of a wholesale attempt to use this kind of defense. So if you have those kinds of concerns, what would you do? Would you wipe it out altogether for prison escape cases? Do me a favor, just not having a choice of evils or necessity defense as a defense to prison breach. Yeah, two hands, three hands. No more bold individuals are going to take that position. Why would you say that we shouldn't have such an defense at all?
Because I think that there are plenty of
Yeah, they can always go administratively and deal with that. What's your rejoinder? All the rest of you who are opposed to that. Yeah.
Obviously, goes administrative. Just don't work.
And if he goes to the prison authorities, that worry about retaliation, but maybe we could accommodate that by building that in as an additional restriction. Well, whatever you say, you've got to try administrative remedies, except in a situation where you obviously not available. So that's one notion, that here we have things built into the prison system even more than in the general population that is designed to deal with exactly these kinds of concerns and potential assault in the prison setting, because it's recognized as a problem. Yeah.
I'd say it's not necessary, because it's a pretty rare occurrence. This is on an honor farm.
Well,
which obviously means that he's a little bit less dangerous than...
Or he wouldn't be in a non-farm.
Moved to that, he's less behind. He's probably on his way out. And
yeah, so this is a...
And also in a regular prison, it's not so easy to just walk off.
And so maybe we should have the defense, because it's not just a big deal, it will rarely apply.
Keep some restrictions, of course, but what you say is it's not that prevalent. It's not that necessary.
Yeah, maybe not that common that people get out. Quite common, though. So maybe that's their face. They risk their lives. That sort of thing. What did we see particularly in the Lover Camp case or in the federal jurisdiction, the kind of limitations that are sometimes thrown in, perhaps to address some of these concerns? Did I thought I saw a hand, but then I didn't. Someone was eating. Yeah. Yeah, and you see that as a common restriction. So in the Lover Camp decision, there was a requirement that the prisoner immediately reports to the proper authorities when he has attained a position of safety from the immediate threat. So, if you get out, you've got to report. If you don't report inside, you're going to have to report outside as soon as you get to a position of safety. And the approach of the Supreme Court for federal cases, reflected in your book on page 801, in the Bailey case, there must be evidence that the defendant made a good faith effort to surrender or return as soon as the necessity had lost its coercive force. So very similar kinds of restrictions there. Any other prominent restrictions here? Yeah.
One was that there is no time for the complaint to be authorities or there exists a history of appeal. Speaking to the administrative remedies,
yeah.
That they either don't have time to speak to the authorities or that ask the plaintiff have to know
that. Which might be something that's built into the structure of the defense, because you'd have to say, well, you're dealing with an imminent harm here, and it's necessary to take this action. Is it really necessary if you have administrative remedies that you haven't fully exploited? But this is sort of underlines as a separate requirement that you make this kind of effort, or there be no time, or that it be clear that because of a prior history that they were unavailing. So, it's not so important the specific permutations in Lover Camp. You see, they were rejected in Unger. But we have an area here where particular contexts may raise particular problems, leading individual jurisdictions to restrict things from the generic pattern of a general justification defense like choice of evils. You were saying also
that you favor not having a defense at all, right?
I'm sorry. I didn't think you were saying that.
You were saying that. Yes.
And so, for example, if there were a fire that breaks out in a prison, the prisoner should burn to death rather than leave the prison.
They should go to an unaffected part of the prison.
And if the fire consumes that part as well,
in that case,
they should burn. And I just use that example. So you can see, at the extreme, somewhere along the line, maybe you need to have a choice of evils defense at some point, at the extreme point. And people would, at least at the extreme point, and others would put the point a little bit further back. If you just deal with a generic justification, well, if you're minimizing harm to society, as a basic notion of justification, then maybe you ought to have, so you see a little range of responses, and sometimes the particular setting is important. Let's see how these general principles play out in a second difficult context, the context of civil disobedience, which brings us to the Shun case in your book on page 804. Who'd like to refresh us on Shun? Was that and while you're thinking about it, if you'd like to do that, yes, sir.
Just wondering, what is the sentencing purpose of this prison escape? It's usually like 10 years.
It varies according to the particular kind of crime that you're serving. So oftentimes you'll have one sentence. It could be 5 years, could be 10 years for a felony, and something lesser for a misdemeanor, or perhaps a year on top of the maximum year that you could get for the misdemeanor. But, of course, each individual jurisdiction can set its maximum.
But, okay, that's kind of a 10 or 15 years because we're trying to stay in your sentence.
Seems a little bit harsh. So you could adjust sentence would be a way to accommodate this too. And we'll come back to think about whether the system could kind of absorb these concerns without having a formal defense as well. But first, let's take a look at the civil disobedience setting in the Shun case. And yes, sir.
There's three defendants, Greg Shun, they went to an IRS office in Arizona to protest U.S. government activities in El Salvador.
And what's the connection with the IRS office?
Well, they felt that the money was going from the IRS directly to the government. The government was funding El Salvador.
Yeah, so keep our tax dollars out of El Salvador was the nature of the protest, and they did what besides sloganeering? No, it was nice. It was simulated blood. After all, how bad is that to clean up? We don't know exactly.
They essentially stopped what was going on. They also prevented everyone from working. They were asked to leave. They didn't leave, and then they were forced to be arrested.
Probably because they wanted to be arrested in that situation, since they wanted to draw attention to U.S. government policy in El Salvador. So even though some notions of civil disobedience, going back to Thoreau, would suggest that if you engage in civil disobedience, you ought to, what?
Those of you who studied Thoreau in college and still remember any of it?
Well, part of the notion is, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, take your lumps. I mean, violate the law if need be. And then take the consequences. And you may get the benefit, you may be even greater benefit as far as publicity goes, if that's what you're out for. But now, once they're arrested, they decide that, no, maybe instead.
Well, they wanted to take a choice of evils and then say it was a necessity that they were doing this.
Yeah, and it's a necessity. What's the concept here?
Well, that they were going to prevent the money from going to the El Salvador government and
or maybe by their protest, influence government action.
Yeah, they would make Congress and change the law, essentially. So
yeah.
Hopefully, through their protest, Congress would change the law
And lots and lots of people wouldn't die in El Salvador as compared. That's on one side of the scale, right? This is how they want to construct a theory. It's on one side of the scale, and on the other side of the scale, a little simulated blood, a little sloganeering, disrupting some people in this bureaucratic office for a little while. Certainly, much more important to save any number of lives in El Salvador, isn't it? What's wrong with that argument?
Well, they weren't necessarily protesting any type of law. They were just trying to draw attention to a cause. It was essentially indirect civil disobedience versus direct civil disobedience.
Yeah, but before we get into the niceties here, because the court focuses on, well, here we have a case of indirect civil disobedience, and they, very interestingly, declare an across-the-board standard for dealing with cases of indirect civil disobedience. But before we get to that, just thinking about notions of justification and choice of evils as we've considered it up to this point, what's wrong with saying, well, my goodness, here we have a harm that's much greater. They're trying to prevent that harm by a harm of a much lesser scale. I'm minimizing the threat to society by what I'm doing. It's not an imminent harm. That is to say, that nobody's going to die tomorrow? No? Okay, well, that's a different position. One would be to say, well, there's no imminent harm. But maybe there is a risk of somebody dying in El Salvador tomorrow. That's not imminent. If it's, what if it's a second from now? So it's a problem of proof. I'm trying to separate two things that you're saying. One, you're saying, well, it's not imminent, but you say, well, the harm is pretty immediate. And the second thing you said is that, well, but what they're doing, what?
It's not really actually going to cause anybody's suffering.
Yeah, you can't. It's pretty hard to get here from, you know, through your method that isn't preventing that person from dying, probably. So the causal connection in stopping the death is through a lot of other interstitial steps, including the actions of policymakers and the rest that you might or might not influence. And this court focuses on that a bit too, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They say that all three of the four elements were satisfied, and it was an imminent harm. There was an imminent harm that they were trying to avert, but the way they were trying to go about it, there was the actions taken wouldn't abate the evil. There were other alternatives, and.
Okay, and those are two separate things. One part, notice the way they lay out their standard. So you're faced with a little variation, again, in how choice of evils is presented. Here they say you're faced with a choice of evils and choose the lesser evil. So you have to be choosing the lesser of two harms. So that's in common to virtually all formulations. Acting to prevent imminent harm, a common element. And they're saying here the harm could be imminent. And then they formulate the balance of the necessity defense is that you have to reasonably anticipate a direct causal relationship between the conduct and the harm to be averted. Direct causal relationship, that is, so that what you do might be effective in averting the harm and having no legal alternatives to violating the law. Now, are those variations on a theme we've already seen? Formulating in that way, well, it has to be something you can anticipate might be effective, and there have to be no alternatives. Are those different ways of saying something within the generic formulation that we're using or not? That I don't have up here, but are now burned into your brain, aren't they? Both of these are a little, yeah? I'm sorry?
Yeah, but remember, self-defense is a particular, a specific formulation of a justification that is not your general choice of evils. It only is involved in a specific situation where you're using unlawful force against somebody else, right? But it rang a little, had a familiar tone, as well it should, because the law of self-defense is often characterized as a law of necessity. And here, if you have alternatives, well, it's not necessary. And how can you say it's necessary if it won't be effective in doing it? I have to turn around three times because this is just about to happen. Well, if there's no connection between those two things, it's hard to say it's necessary. So this is sort of an elaboration of when something is necessary. So they have their slightly different formulation.
And on the point of the likelihood that the harm will abate, there's this causal connection between the what they're doing and abating the harm that they see in El Salvador.
They felt that was very unlikely because even if it gained public attention, it would still have to go through Congress to eventually change the law to prevent the money from El Salvador.
So there are all these connections before there's an effect from what they do. So it's very it's not. You could say it's not necessary to avert the harm to do this because it's not even effective to avert the harm to do this. And as far as having alternatives to violating the law, what kind of alternatives are they when you've got the United States government doing this? And what can a poor boy do? You know, you play in a rock and roll band, or maybe you protest at the IRS.
Yeah, you can lobby Congress, you can call your senator, you can do a lot of other things besides.
And that's what they say. There are always legal alternatives in this situation, including petitioning Congress for a change in the law. And you could say, well, that won't work. Is it any less likely to work than going down to the IRS office? Yeah.
They also don't think that in 1987, the political class was a lot different. There wasn't the kind of transparency that happened today. Very few people actually knew about it.
So maybe the need for publicity.
Yeah,
and then, you know, they needed the publicity in order to get some kind of petition to Congress.
Yeah, so it could be one step in a multi-step process that would include petitioning Congress. But notice, so they do talk about both those things as being loose gears here in the application of a choice of evils or necessity defense. But there's something else that's really standing in the way of the use of a choice of evils defense here. And it has to do with the nature of the harm that they're protesting. What are they? Yes, sir.
The harm has to be directed to the person who's protesting.
So they're making this distinction between indirect civil disobedience and direct civil disobedience. Direct civil disobedience would be what now?
Direct would be the example of three protesters sitting at a countertop at a second-rate restaurant,
violating the very law that they're protesting. Now here you have, why is this a case of indirect civil disobedience?
Because they're protesting through a legal act, something which doesn't directly affect them in any way.
They're not saying that the government should not be taxing people. They're really saying that tax dollars shouldn't be used in this particular way, so there's some connection. But they don't think that the whole tax structure is illegal in some sense. So you have indirect cases of civil disobedience and direct cases of civil disobedience. And in the case of indirect civil disobedience, of which this is an example, what does the court say?
It says you'll never have a necessity of defenses.
Never, ever. Why not? Is it just because of what we've talked about so far?
You're not challenging any, you're just breaking up the law for the sake of throwing attention to the clause. You're not breaking that law for any other reason but that.
Yeah, and so why would that never work as a choice of evils defense?
Because it seems to just be encouraging people to commit crimes to draw attention to their own cause.
Their own cause, which is in disagreement with government policy.
It's a protested concept they assert that purview of what is that should trump the decision.
So when you have government policy in play, this is already reflecting a balance, a judgment about the balance of harms. Is it better to go into El Salvador with all the costs associated with that? Is it better to stay out? Those government policy decisions in a democracy are thought to reflect a balance of judgment that goes all the way back to the people. In a sense, but the balance has already been struck. And you were going to say?
I was
going to
say, it's also never necessary. It's never something that would be considered necessary.
Because of the presence of these legal alternatives and perhaps the ineffectiveness.
The fact that there's no evidence that it would ever help.
The uncertainty of the causal connection. But notice they say that the harm that they're protesting when they're focusing on government policy is... that a constitutional law or policy, as long as it's constitutional, is not a legally cognizable harm. So they're saying, well, you think it's something bad here, but this is what our whole system has produced, this policy. So it's not a legally cognizable harm. If it's not a legally cognizable harm, there's no harm on the harm side of the scale, quite apart from all the rest. And so, in cases of indirect civil disobedience, you're never going to achieve the appropriate balance. And the text indicates that appellate courts have overwhelmingly refused to allow necessity defenses to be raised in cases like this. And they're talking about civil disobedience cases generally. Shun is unusual in making this across-the-board statement about cases of indirect civil disobedience. What about cases of direct civil disobedience? Could we say the same thing about cases of direct civil disobedience? When you're prevented from sitting at a particular lunch counter, you go ahead and do it. You raise a choice of evils offense if that were against the law under the circumstances. Isn't that a law that has already been the product of a democratic system that has produced this judgment?
Yeah. It shouldn't be allowed without the event if there was no other option to teach. Like, that's the only place that you could get this nourishment and you kind of shouldn't have.
Oh, so that I wouldn't die. So the choice between my dying but not in order to protest this unfair law that kept you away from the counter when it didn't.
He's our option.
So what you're saying is that in virtually all cases, choices of direct civil disobedience also would not be with the choice of evil's defense. Even cases of direct civil disobedience, am I with you there? Depending, so you could say, well, if I, but you almost don't have to use a case of civil disobedience. If I was starved and I pulled this apple from the tree, by almost my dying breath, and it wasn't my apple, well, yeah, maybe I have a choice of evil. We don't have to get it.
Yeah. You'd have to ask several steps of appellate court to actually get something to court. Because if you're in a community that has a restriction like that, your local laws aren't what's going to allow something like this.
Yeah, and notice, if you've got a constitutional law, you don't have a cognizable harm, you're saying. You don't have a cognizable harm. But this is a mechanism where you can start the ball rolling to challenge the law itself. That's why direct civil disobedience is different. But you can challenge the law itself, and at the end of the line, you might get a ruling that the law in general is unconstitutional, or maybe its application to you is illegal in some fashion. Either which way, doesn't look like choice of evils would really have much of a play in cases of civil disobedience. And I challenge you to find a case in which there's been a successfully raised a choice of evil's defense in a civil disobedience case, whether direct or indirect. Yeah.
Well, if we, you know, have an illegal rally for the, you know, against the segregation, that would be indirect civil disobedience because we're not sitting at the counters. But that still might.
Yeah, but maybe you haven't complied with the requirement to get a permit to rally in a particular street, or you're in the middle of an interstate or something of that sort. Indirect civil disobedience, Shun, and other cases will probably follow Shun to say, look, your choice of evils defense won't work. But might that not produce good effects in the long run? Well, if you're protesting something illegal, then, you're not protesting the laws that allow the cars to move freely on the interstate.
Right.
But you see how you're in trouble in that case of indirect civil disobedience, too. You won't even be able to challenge the legality of any particular law through that process. But you will draw attention to things. And in the Henry David Thoreau notion, why, then, yeah, if you have the courage to do that, you might foster change in the long run at some personal cost. And that just makes your activity all the more moral, perhaps. So, what do you think we should do to deal with conscientious, truly conscientious, morally based disobedience of criminal law? Can we distinguish these cases from others in which an individual decides to override the law because they want to for one reason or another? Think of the protester who sits on a railroad track maybe to prevent animals from being transported for experimentation that the protester disagrees with, or releases animals who will be just used to test cosmetics and that sort of thing. And should we deal with these folks differently, or should we, in a way, close the doors of the choice of evils defense to these kinds of activities? Someone had a comment in there. I couldn't quite figure it out.
I'm not sure how you can craft a special defense for it unless, you know, judges could, you know, take the intent and motives of crimes and maybe give them a lesser sentence. You know, they're willing to do this good. They're willing to commit a crime.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that they need a special defense. They might need special care and sentencing.
Maybe they're not the most dangerous criminals out there, although they're still criminal and violate the law. So you could say, even without a justification for general choice of evils defense being applicable, you could say this across the board in a way. You could wipe out choice of evils or just a general justification defense, and you still have some mechanisms within the law to deal with the matter. One would be what judges can do in exercising their sentencing authority. The person's guilty, but I'm going to distinguish this case from others in my sentence. We have other actors in the system, too. How else could this be accommodated within our legal system besides through this cross-cutting defense in which somebody just walks out the door? I'm going to use my discretion as a prosecutor. Even though there's been a technical violation of the law, I recognize that it wouldn't be a good use of resources to focus our attention on this individual who's really acting morally, who maybe I kind of admire under the circumstances. And so you have the discretion of judges, you have the discretion of prosecutors. Do you have anything else? Yeah. Politicians could pardon the offender when they get into what position? So you've got to have politicians who have made it to a position like governor or president, and so they can use their pardon authority. And that's traditionally been a way to soften the hard edges of the law in unusual cases. So you have the authority of prosecutors, juries, judges, governors, and I let's slip out juries, because what can juries do?
They can find them guilty.
Even when they're guilty?
Yeah,
absolutely. So juries have the power to nullify. And that's why in figuring out whether to raise the defense or not, consider the power of the jury to nullify. Even if your defense doesn't really apply, maybe if I can get instruction about it, maybe the jury will nullify. Maybe if I can't get an instruction, I can get enough facts on the table about what was really going on. The community will step in, exercise its discretion by using a nullification authority. And in most jurisdictions, except for Wisconsin, you can't get an instruction about the power of the jury to nullify, but the jury does have that power. And so all those things could in effect accommodate situations, including civil disobedience situations, but you could say all those things could be available in other choice of evils settings too. And I'll take one more step to think about existing law outside of the cross-cutting defense, but first, yes, ma'am? Yes, so before you even get to the prosecution stage, there's vast discretion on the part of police officers, which I decided not to charge. Is that illegal? Yeah, and in most circumstances and in most jurisdictions, police officers don't have to arrest, even when they have probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and their presence are outside the presence. There's a beginning of an erosion of that discretionary authority with mandatory arrest statutes in, for example, domestic abuse situations and things like that. So it's a little erosion of that authority, but it's still there. Yes, sir?
Yeah, if they don't arrest, couldn't that be an accessory act?
No, not if they're lawfully exercising their discretion. Not if they're lawfully exercising their discretion. You're saying they're helping. But in a way, you remember, police officers very often have their own choice of evils defense, don't they? They're breaking the law all the time, aren't they? They run red lights right in front of you. Do they care? No. And they break... They do things that nominally break criminal law in other ways, too. But the thought is that the balance of harm favors them, and they're serving the purposes underlying law enforcement. So really, all these things fit right into the notions of justification. Let's say you had a situation in which the engineer on a steamboat built up steam in the boiler. Remember that building up steam in the boiler case? And he did that on purpose, and he let the needle go beyond the safety zone into the red. Captain, I don't think she can take much more. Load it on there. Load it. And more and more steam in the boiler, all because the captain and the engineer wanted to prevent the boat from going over Niagara Falls. Now, if you had no generic choice of evils defense, would you nonetheless have a legal avenue of incorporating their concerns here if there was, for example, a charge of reckless endangerment? Let's say in this case nobody died, or you could have reckless homicide for that matter if you prefer, a kind of manslaughter.
Yes, because recklessness is seen as judged by first under circumstances.
Yeah.
In those circumstances, it's an emergency situation.
And recklessness in particular is defined how?
A gross and unjustifiable risk.
Did you hear what he said? Unjustifiable. Justification principle built right in to the concepts of negligence and recklessness, as defined by the model. So remember, if you should have known or did know of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, that's the notion of justification is built right in. You can say, well, yeah, they knew all about this, but it was a justified risk under the circumstances. So the same concept is built into the very diction and structure of negligence and recklessness as defined under the model penal code. One last little bit. Before we move on to duress, take a quick look at the Model Penal Code Choice of Evils provision in your book on page 1088. It's section 3.02, Justification Generally, Choice of Evils. And that's the idea. It's a residual principle of justification. Notice it provides a conduct which the actor believes to be necessary to avoid or harm or evil to himself or another is justifiable, provided that. Now, first notice that in this first formulation, it's not saying reasonably believes, it's saying believes in this formulation. A person believes it to be necessary to avoid or harm or evil to himself or another is justifiable, provided that the harm or evil sought to be avoided by such conduct is greater than that sought to be prevented by the law defining the offense charged. So the same kind of concept that we see in general formulations of choice of evil. You don't have exceptions dealing with this specific situation in the 1B section. Or C, notice this language, a legislative purpose to exclude the justification claim does not otherwise plainly appear. And the idea there is that, well, you don't really have a lesser harm in that situation because, again, the balance of harms has already been determined by government policy. So in general, when that's the case, you don't get to re-argue things that have been worked out by a lawful legislative process. What if the person unreasonably believes that it was necessary in the circumstances? Take a look at the subsection 2. When the actor was reckless or negligent in bringing about the situation requiring a choice of harms, that's its corollary to the idea of a person being without blame in bringing about the situation, or in appraising the necessity. So if you make a mistake, and that mistake is negligent or reckless in appraising the necessity of your conduct, given the balance of harms, the justification afforded by this section is unavailable in a prosecution for any offense for which recklessness or negligence, as the case may be, suffices to establish culpability. You see what's going on here? They say if you make a mistake in evaluating necessity, why then, if you look at whether you have a negligent mistake or a reckless mistake, if you have a negligent mistake, then you can if you make a reckless mistake, then you can be guilty of offense for which recklessness is required. This is the same approach they took to self-defense. Don't get fooled in the beginning of self-defense. They act as if it sounds like a subjective standard. But then you have to look, well, what if a person makes an unreasonable judgment about necessity in the self-defense context? Same deal. If it's negligent, then you can be guilty of an offense. If it's reckless, you can be guilty of other things as far as recklessness. So if in the get situation, you make an unreasonable guesstimate, an unreasonable assessment of the need to use deadly force in these circumstances. And let's say he makes a reckless mistake. He's aware of the risk that he's wrong. He goes ahead and makes that judgment. He must be guilty of it. This is back in the self-defense situation. Kind of a tricky question, because here we're talking about charges of attempt. So we have attempt requires a purpose to produce the result. There's no corollary negligent attempt, no corollary recklessness. So if he makes a mistake under the law, he'll go for a motion, and then he would fall back. But this is the general structure that the Model Penal Code uses in the structure of self-defense, which is a kind of justification, and again, with the justification generally, defense, the choice of evils defense we just looked at on page 1088. Final questions about choice of evils? Yes, sir? In a jurisdiction that had a reckless danger endangerment statute, and it's somewhat rare, although sort of catching on, when you recklessly put someone in danger, often of their life, is the way it's formulated. And then you could be guilty of an offense like that. Why don't we take our break now, and we'll come back, take care of duress, and start on insanity if we can. Let's see, I have 7 before, so we go through 3 after.
At 37.
Oh, okay, good.
One case.
Great.
Google versus Gray.
Yeah.
Members of his organization motivated and had this airplane were acquitted of disorderly conduct for the demonstration of the entrance of a bridge with elements of the necessity that could not disprove beyond a reasonable doubt. But every single other one said that.
Yeah, at least they got the instruction.
Right.
Great. Yeah.
Here, see, the justification for choice of evil was unavailable to the defendants who saw it by charges of everybody. But I read a little bit of the court's opinion, and they said, although although most New York cases have held otherwise, we found other jurisdictions that hold this way. So,
well, I'm glad I challenged your finding.
There you go.
At least you got the instructions.
Yeah.
And let's see.
Was actually, what is it?
Direct civil disobedience. Has there their position? Interest to the bridge. Yeah, because they're saying.
Or no, stop the traffic from the airport.
Right. Yeah. That's indirect civil disobedience. So that would be.
Very difficult. A level to get that.
Yeah, even if you got the instructions, it'd be hard to win.
Right.
But it's hard. It's almost impossible to get the instructions.
Right. And 37 cases came up here. Every single one, except for this one, said denied the defense.
Interesting.
He wants to use it otherwise.
Thank you.
think you just said that gaslighting. Seriously. Let me see if I got this right.
Yeah.
He's saying if he unreasonably believed it was that he was under a, someone trying to kill him, then we told, we can't hold him to attempted murder, we hold him to recklessness. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the modern civil code formulation doesn't deal with it really, really well.
Okay.
So let's say, he believes that that it was necessary to undertake these actions.
And that's right.
So he had, and let's say he's aware of the risk that he's wrong about that,
right.
So he's making a reckless mistake. If you look at the formulation of self-defense, they say you have to he has to believe that all these
right.
things, and then if he has an unreasonable belief, that's the same kind of structure. It doesn't work at all well when you start with attempted murder as the top charge, because you don't have reckless attempted murder and you don't have negligent attempted murder. So you have to look for another offense like reckless endangerment or something else of which he's guilty when you have
something else.
Yeah. Okay. It's not that he wouldn't be guilty.
With the language.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Why killing under duress?
Murder.
Say again? Killing us under duress?
Yeah. Under duress does not consider. Is not considered.
Why duress is not considered a defense murder. It really has to do with history and tradition that in these extreme cases, even if a person of reasonable firmness would go ahead and kill, that you kill him and let, or I'll kill you. Maybe human beings would do that. We want to tighten up their resistance as much as we can. So traditionally it hasn't been a defense to murder. And you have a lot of history even in choice of evil, not making that a defense potential. Homicide. But in modern formulations, you usually can use choice of evils as a defense to the killing of a person when you're saving more than one person by thereby.
I see this as a kind of self-defense because you don't have any choice. It's all happening to die.
Right, and they're saying here your choice is to die. You know?
Yeah.
So they're saying we're going to have a standard of heroism to be a hero. You'll have to be a hero here if the choice is between killing somebody and dying yourself. You'll have to die yourself. That's something that people will do, right?
I don't understand.
Yeah.
Is he a helpless guy? Does he have duty to help? And from that side, you have to, kill this guy when you're in your own fear.
Yeah, when you need to save yourself. Yeah, and as like you said, for being able to choose yourself over someone else, even when that other person is honest. But that's not reflected in the history of duress. And I think part of the thought is that we want to do everything we can to screw people's courage up before they kill anyone. And so we'll even put in kind of draconian limitations so that maybe in a close call situation, a person will take a certain risk about their own life.
I was shocked completely. This voluntary investigation. In defense of those specific intent crimes, I don't understand this at all.
Yeah.
In Russia, you're drunk, my God. No, not my God, but someone poured it to somebody.
Involuntary intoxication.
Yeah. But voluntarily, away, you know what?
Yeah.
Not intent.
Yeah, involuntary as a mens rea defense, when the mens rea is high enough, but it doesn't function. If you're unaware of the risk, you would have been aware of the risk. So if you are actually only negligent in your state of mind, you're treated as if you're reckless. So you get a little bit of a penalty, but then you can function as a defense when you talk about your knowledge.
Professor, I'm struggling with
You mean first plane or
with monotony failed
Yeah. Well, that's what we'll be working on the rest of the way.
I don't see the big difference. Monotony failed, you have to have total don't know anything. But, let's say, you know, on a bar exam, say, you also want to say, you know,
I don't know that they, I mean, I don't think that you know for sure what
you're in that state.
Majority is now not what it used to be. Before the Hinckley case, when John Hinckley attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan, before that, it was all swings in the Model Penal Code. And then he got an insanity defense, and all went swinging back the other way. And so now you have a majority as a non. If they follow a majority, I'm not sure they're moving. If they follow a majority, but we'll go through the comparison. You know, how is it different, really, from. Oh, the mountain one? Yeah, it's kind of neat. Yeah, because, I mean, when you get assassination attempts, it's kind of the same here, because we had attempted assassination of the president, and all of a sudden, all the legislators got in the act, and there was a whole bunch of new laws and changes in the jurisdictions after that, so not too different from when Queen Victoria was worried about it. Okay, now, let's turn our attention from the defense of necessity or choice of evils, remember that is one and the same defense, to the defense of duress. Thereby, we'll be moving through the zone that straddles justification and excuse. So we're moving from justification towards excuse. A case. You're a parent. I come up holding your small child by the hand. In my other hand, I have a small glass vial holding a bubbling liquid. I say, I'm going to splash this acid on your son's face. Unless you break into your neighbor's house, bring me back that string of black Tahitian pearls that I know is on the dresser in the bedroom. You do as you're told, and you're charged with burglary and grand larceny. Now, without worrying about defenses, and the legal notions that you've learned from your reading, what arguments, in particular, what moral arguments would you make on your own behalf if you broke into your neighbor's house and took those Tahitian pearls? Yeah. Well, that sounds like putting it in a particular legal category. Just how would you say nobody should put me in jail for this if you were talking over the coffee table? So you say my will was undermined by this threat under the circumstance, but you had a choice. You could let your son be disfigured. If it indeed was that, maybe it wasn't. It was your hand over the
phone? Yes, sir.
I didn't want any harm to come to my son. Yeah, but, you know, your neighbor doesn't want to lose the string of Tahitian black pearls either. And so why is it that... So you should do what's good for you.
No.
So why is it that it's right?
You're not doing it for you. You're doing it for your son.
Why is it right to do it for your son here is what I'm asking. What? Yeah. And? Yes, ma'am. So you're saying, well, here, yeah, there's... So this is putting it in the
contradiction, and this is what I want us to be listening for when you give an argument in favor of doing this. What diction are you putting it into? And you put it explicitly into the diction of justification. You're saying, I made the right choice, and it's the right choice because the value that I got, that is my son not being burned by acid on his face, is more important. There's more value there than what I was taking away by breaking in, which I acknowledge is wrong. So it's a choice of evils. But the diction that you're talking about is the diction of justification, of minimizing harm to society when things are properly valued. Now, you could also put it in other terms. How else could you say, you shouldn't be holding me accountable here in a negative way? Yeah.
Well, I did something wrong by stealing them, but I was doing it for a good reason.
Yeah, and the good reason was that I was minimizing harm to society, or... Or something else. There is something else here. What if instead of the diction of justification, you use the diction of excuse? What would you say? Yes, sir.
You said that fear of having your son's face disfigured is not something they could live with, so you had no other choices.
And anybody else put in my shoes, or ordinary people of ordinary firmness put in my shoes, would react the same way as I did. I'm not an outlier here. I'm not a criminal. I'm not a fringe element. I'm just mainstream human. And an ordinary human would be frail in the same ways that I'm frail. And maybe I couldn't...
I would effectively have no choice here. And so if you're saying that, you know, in my shoes, anyone of ordinary firmness would have done the same thing, right or wrong, then you're using the diction of excuse as opposed to the diction of justification, which is always, well, here I'm minimizing harm to society. When you use the diction of excuse, you're saying whether you're minimizing harm to society or not, I can't be blamed because I'm no worse than you are, or no worse than the ordinary run of people. Yes, sir.
Can you bring up the mens rea, even though, I mean, technically you intend to go in?
Yeah, and what part of the mens rea might you lack?
Could you do the elements analysis?
You could, and you'd lose, wouldn't you? Because you're intending to break and enter the dwelling of another with a specific intent to commit a crime therein, because you intend to be permanently depriving the people of their black Tahitian pearls. So ordinarily, yeah, I mean, you might have a mens rea defense sometimes, and then you just haven't committed the crime. But cross-cutting defenses, including choice of evils and duress, apply even if all the elements are met. Yes. Can't use innocent agency as a defense. Remember, innocent agency is a concept that is when you are using an innocent agent to accomplish something. By, for example, threatening the person. That person, if they have a defense, it would be a duress defense because you're threatening them. If it fits within the duress defense, they have that defense, not an innocent agency defense. This is just how the words are used. Innocent agency, on the other hand, is when you're using that person as the agent so that you become the principal. If that person succumbs to your duplicity, succumbs to your coercion, and undertakes the actions, they're doing it as your agent, and that's the sort of baseball bat situation when you're using somebody, just like picking one person up and throwing them into the other. So it's the improper use of words to say, I have an innocent agency defense. You'd have to cast your defense in other terms, like, I have a duress defense, I have a choice of evils defense, not an innocent agency defense. Yeah.
But if the person who uses the innocent agent as a becomes the principal, so if that case goes to court, then they come, well, so now you committed this crime, and they're like, no, I didn't, I was innocent agent, go look at that crime.
I know, and I'm telling you, what you should say instead is, I had a choice of evils and I made the right choice. Or, I have a duress defense, I have an excuse here, even though I made the wrong choice. So you just have to put it in the right terminology. It's not that the concept isn't the same. Now, the same sort of thing as in this situation with the bubbling vial of acid can be said of the bank teller. Looking down the barrel of a shotgun, and he empties out the vault, even drives the getaway car. And we wouldn't even think, we wouldn't consider charging the bank teller with bank robbery on an accomplice theory, would we? If we did, he'd end up having a defense like a duress or a choice of evils defense. And notice here, they're overlapping. You probably say, well, it's better that he lives, even if there's a loss of funds at the bank. So the choice of evils was the correct choice of evils. And moreover, for people of ordinary firmness, we yield to a threat on their life, even if it meant some people losing their property. So you have both the considerations associated with justification and excuse. But what of the case where you're not so sanguine about the balance of harms? What if the choice of evils that doesn't minimize harm to society, but that a person of reasonable firmness couldn't resist making? I'll shoot your son in the leg unless you shoot him in the leg. You have the same kind of evils. But maybe a person of reasonable firmness couldn't resist doing that. In that case, we move fully from justification to excuse. Now let's begin to explore the contours of a duress defense by looking at State v. Toscano. In your book on page 833, this is a false medical reports case. We'd like to refresh this a little bit more. Or if you like, the whisper in the alleyway case. You'll jump the chairs when you come up.
Leonardo's. We're going to refresh this on the fact that it's done.
Sure. Dr. Toscano was a chiropractor. He was charged with aspiring to obtain money from a cover insurance company. And what he did was...
this is really an insurance fraud case, and he got sucked into it how? Well, that's the government theory, that here he had some gambling debts, and maybe he could pay them off by helping out these thugs, perhaps mafioso, but we don't know that. That's the prosecution theory, but what happened? Yeah, so we don't get a real explicit threat. It's not, we'll kill you if. It's Leonardo sounding vicious and desperate. As you're going to make this bill out for me, you just moved into a place with a very dark entrance. You and your wife are going to jump at shadows when you leave. He didn't call the police. He ended up going along with this fraud scheme and helping out with the putting together falsified documents, right, medical claims. How come, according to his story here?
He said he thought about calling the police, but he thought that if he went along with it, it would just go away, and that eventually Leonardo would be alone, and all this would just blow over. And, I mean,
yeah, so there are some things that maybe suggest to us to
if what he's telling us is accurate here, you're saying that he moved away. And what else did he do that's kind of consistent with this story? What did he get out of it, for example?
He didn't get anything out of it.
So apparently he got no compensation. He ends up moving. He does what else to try to maybe get out from under these threats? Anyone? He tried to get a gun, but he couldn't. Sort of like Getz tried to get a gun license. He couldn't, so he had an illegal one. He changed his phone number. And he also told co-workers about the threat. So we have a few things that sort of build up the notion that the way he's describing things might have been accurate rather than just a big lie. So the court was trying to figure out whether there's sufficient evidence here to raise a duress defense after the trial court instructed the jury that there was insufficient evidence on that point, so they're not getting a proper instruction on duress. And what's the bottom line? What's the conclusion of the court about whether there should have been a duress instruction?
The court decided that there should have been a duress instruction because he was coerced to do his actions by use of threats.
Let's kind of zero in on what should have been the content of the instruction that would describe the duress defense, because the court looks at the common law, but then actually adopts another kind of approach. What kind of instruction should have been given here? Okay, so serious bodily harm would be enough. Would it have to be death or serious bodily harm as the nature of the threat?
Yes.
That's the common law standard. Are they sticking by that standard? So you can see here that there's some variation in the application of the standards. You can see the common law approach and what the court's adopting here, which is a little bit different. And as to whether it has to be a threat of death or serious bodily harm, which was the common law standard, what does the court say?
Now it's just their coerced to do it unlawful for a force against a person or a person of another, which a person of reasonable firmness in that situation would be able to resist.
Okay, so, and that's quite a lot different. They say on, I guess this is on 836, addresses a defense to crimes. Notice that they're saying other than murder. So duress, as was traditional, this court is saying can't be used as a defense to murder, where conduct due to coercion by the use of or threat of unlawful force against the self or another. So it wouldn't have to be a threat for this court's formulation. Wouldn't have to be a threat of death or serious bodily harm, so long as a person of reasonable firmness in the defendant's situation would have been unable to resist. So the court is adopting a standard that's derived in some ways from the model penal code standard. I see a hand or two. Yeah? No? Now, I'm going to give you a generic kind of duress defense that's probably the most common formulation that you see. You can see in here some variation between the common law and what the Toscano court is adopting. But let's just work with the situation Toscano and this standard that I just laid out for a moment. Would you say, you were talking about not having any choice, as maybe being the basis for a duress defense. Would you say that Toscano's conduct was involuntary in monofield code terms? Would you say Toscano's conduct was involuntary? Why not involuntary? I'm sorry? Yeah. It's voluntary in model penal code terms if... So, voluntary initiative has to do with mens rea? I'm intentionally asking you to flash all the way back when we were talking about actus reus and when you have a voluntary act, an involuntary act defense. Yes, sir? In the duress defense, but I'm actually asking something different because I want to distinguish the notion of involuntary conduct from the notion of duress. And when we're thinking back to what involuntary conduct is, what? I'm sorry?
You don't act under your will in a certain way.
So you're it's not a willed action. Remember, the language under the definitional sections, if you have a bodily movement that is the product of the effort or determination of the actor, that is to say, the product of the actor's will, then you have voluntary action in model penal code terms. And applying that standard to Toscano, what would you say? Toscano is the guy who's been threatened. You're going to jump at shadows. Your wife's going to jump at shadows. And the guy's speaking in a real scary voice. It's not what? It's not a real threat? I kind of think of it as a real threat. But is it action involuntary due to the real threat that we have here?
I would just reason it as he wouldn't have done this otherwise. He wasn't determined.
Yeah, so you could say that there's a causal connection between this threat or these words, anyway, and what he did. That's not the same as saying it's involuntary, though, is it? Because here he's making a bodily movement when he's filling out the forms. It's a product of his the effort of determination of the actor. Remember that you have voluntary conduct even when you're making a hard choice, as long as you're using your will to decide something. It's the difference between getting thrown against the wall and a person. If a person holds a gun to your head and says, jump into the wall, face first, is that a voluntary act in model penal code terms? Yeah. It's a bodily movement that's a product of your will. You made a hard choice in the face of this threat. So I just want to distinguish those things. We're not talking about a lack of volition. It does affect volition. It kind of limits your choices, puts you in the way of hard choices, but it's not involuntary in model penal code terms. Would you say that Toscano has a choice of evils or necessity defense? Before we get to the duress application, as you're thinking about that, yes, sir?
No, I think the duress necessity doesn't apply.
Because? So, choice of evils, you're saying, does not apply when it's a person, right?
No.
Duress doesn't apply when it's a person?
Nature would apply by duress. A person would apply.
Okay. So, here you're saying it could be a choice of evils defense. Let's clean this up in case you're getting confused about natural perils. Historically, necessity defense was limited to natural perils like an avalanche, things like that. In modern formulations and in the formulations that we've seen, it wasn't limited, was it, to natural perils. It could be a peril that comes from a human being, and you could still have a choice of evils if you're minimizing harm in those circumstances and all the other requirements are met. Notice that we'll be focusing in that under the duress defense, it has to be a threat that comes from what source? A human source. So natural perils won't work
for a duress defense, even in modern formulations. Both kinds of concerns, whether we have a human, a potential for a human harm, or a natural peril that's threatening harm, would pump into a choice of evils defense in the modern formulation. But even in modern formulations, duress, the threat in duress has to come from a human agent. Now, let's snap back to the question, which was, forgetting duress for a moment, but using the Toscano situation, would Toscano have a choice of evils defense, would you say?
No, because he also has to come up with the police.
Yeah, he had alternatives. So is it really necessary? He decided not to go to the police in this situation. He hoped it would go away. Now, you might develop more facts to say to suggest that that there were real risks associated with going to the police. But you have to reasonably believe that your conduct is necessary, and it's not necessary if you have alternatives. And if going to the police is a real alternative, then maybe the choice of evils defense wouldn't work. Yes, sir?
Would the police have been able to do anything?
What do you think?
They didn't make direct threats to
the person. There are these kind of suggestions. You're going to jump at shadows. Most jurisdictions do have a threat to do bodily harm kind of crime. And here, it may not have been explicit enough for them to be able to arrest this guy, but they might have been able to talk to Leonardo, you know, in uniform. They could have affected things a little bit. Any other reasons why choice of evils might not work out? Okay, so here, down the line, something might happen to you or your wife. Do we really have an imminent threat? So we have the same kind of problem. Well, what are we going to do about these future harms that might be down the line? When traditionally, for choice of evils, we know that there's an imminence requirement. And what about traditionally for duress? Was there an imminence requirement?
Yes.
Yeah, under common law, you had to be a situation where you had, as the court put it, a present, imminent, and pending the threat of present, imminent, or impending death or serious bodily harm was a common law approach. How about the balance of harms here? How would that work out under a choice of evils defense? Yeah.
I think if the harm you're committing is lesser evil,
if you have a reasonable belief that what he's doing here is saying we're going to break your arm, injure your wife, perhaps kill you, we don't know because it's a little bit vague, so you'd have to work that out. But you might have a choice of lesser harm in this situation. So holding up duress on the one hand and choice of evils, what are the real differences? And to do that, let me give you a generic formulation of the duress defense. Differs just a little from the Toscano formulation, but probably represents the currently dominant approach. You do see some variation in the contours of this defense, just like you do the necessity or choice of evils defense. But generally, conduct that's otherwise illegal is what makes this a cross-cutting defense. Is excused by duress. So it's usually conceived of as an excuse. You might also have a choice of evils that would apply in the same situation. If you are, and it's a generic formulation that's typical in most jurisdictions, again, without blame and bringing about the situation,
one classic example where you may have blame in bringing about the duress situation would be what? Yeah.
Possibly about a wife.
Because maybe you would have done something to sort of invite threats. Be sure you're seated in between a couple of people who are kind of covering their faces at the moment. I'm not sure. But you're saying that the person who stays is to blame for any threats that come after that point? You're not quite saying that. But there are lots of other situations in which you can anticipate. Maybe your arm would be twisted and you go ahead anyway, like what?
You're associated with your girls.
Yeah. And so one classic situation is when you join a gang and you engage in a bunch of kind of low-level illegality, and then it escalates a little bit, and then once you break in somewhere or do some drive-by shooting or something, maybe you can anticipate that you would be threatened by force because that's their modus operandi, and then you're not without blame in bringing about the situation in which you may have been threatened. So, without blame and bringing about the situation, if you're without blame and coerced by a threat from another, and this is where embedded in this formulation is the notion that the threat must come from a human agency. Not threatened by an avalanche or anything else, but threatened by another person. Threat, coerced by a threat from another of... Now, unlike Toscano, the typical formulation is, follows the common law, a threat of imminent death or serious bodily harm. But that can be a threat to you or to another. Which a person of reasonable firmness in your situation would be unable to resist. Here again, we have this formulation that we've seen before. What are you going to count in the situation of a person? And generally, you count gross physical features, the gender of the individual, but you don't count variations in temperament because you're talking about a person of reasonable firmness. And you don't say a person of reasonable firmness in the situation of somebody who has a very timid, meek character. So you don't count those idiosyncrasies of mind of that sort. And generally, jurisdictions still don't make the defense available for intentional homicide. But the defense is not available. That is, if you're threatened, maybe with death, if you don't kill someone else, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to die. You're supposed to be a hero in that circumstance. and that's a carryover from the common law approach, even though maybe a person of reasonable firmness would yield to that sort of threat. So let's think for a moment about what primarily distinguishes this defense, the defense of duress, from what we saw already for the generic, most common version of the choice of evils defense. And as we're thinking about that, I saw a couple of hands. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry? No, you're wondering if it has to be a close family member, for example. No, not in the formulation you see most commonly. So it can be a threat to you is what you most commonly see, or another. You have historically had some limitations on who could count, but generally speaking, it includes even those who aren't related to you. So it could be a stranger who's faced a gun to the head of a stranger, forcing you to engage in a crime that's non-intentional homicide. You also might have a choice of evils in that situation, where you're minimizing harm to that to society by minimizing harm to that other. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. So, for example, let's say you are threatened with death if you don't participate in a dangerous felony. You participate in the dangerous felony, and in the course of that felony, somebody dies. Are you? Do you have a defense? And the most common answer would be, yeah, because it's okay that you've engaged in the underlying felony. And generally speaking, we're focusing on murders, intentional homicides in particular. And so, but I have to ask, answer generically, because you get significant variation in the contours of these defenses. So, what are the primary distinctions here between choice of evils and duress? Remember, both of them started off kind of similarly, being with, in the generic formulations, being without blame in bringing about the situation. Yeah?
Well, the single biggest difference is that under duress, the crime you're committing doesn't have to be less wrong than the crime under blame.
Yeah, so here you can actually be making the wrong choice of evils, and theoretically, you might be able to have a duress defense. Yeah?
It's also, in duress, there's no specific requirement of reasonably believing the conduct is necessary. Being coerced seems is similar, but it doesn't seem as strict.
Yeah, you have to be a person of reasonable firmness. And so that's sort of the version of a being a reasonable person. Here you have to react as a person of reasonable firmness would. So that's the variation on that notion. Yeah.
A natural threat is not an expense of the rest, but only a necessity.
Yeah, so here you have to have a threat. I'm sorry, I did the wrong another. You have to have a threat from another. So the threat cannot be one that the nature of the harm can't be from a natural peril, and that's a difference. Notice that it uses the diction of excuse, because we're talking about what a person of reasonable firmness would do here. We're not talking the diction of justification, and that's why you can even have a defense when you're not minimizing harm to society. The idea is that you're not sufficiently blameworthy to have the stigma of crime attached to you if you're just like the rest of us. Yeah.
I was just going to ask what they use serious bodily harm, but do they give any guidelines as to what's serious? Because grievous is used,
Yeah, those aren't significant differences, even though you sometimes see grievous bodily harm, sometimes you see serious bodily harm, and you do see some variation in different contexts of exactly what that means. The common kind of definition that you see, even if there's grievous use rather than serious, is bodily harm that risks your life, that's included. And also commonly included is bodily harm that's serious enough to disable you permanently, or to, in some jurisdictions, disfigure you permanently in a very serious way. So you get some variation, but that's the kind of package that you tend to see whether you see language like grievous bodily harm or serious bodily harm.
Yeah, that's pretty serious.
But clearly, they're distinguishing really serious harm from things that are minor, even though they carry some risk, maybe a small risk. So let's say, yeah.
Why is it that words are so rarely allowed to justify things, but in this case, if they tell you you're going to kill something in some way, like in this case, Scano, words were allowed as opposed to provocation, where generally it's not allowed.
Yeah. Notice a threat can include more than words, but it could include only words. And it depends on what a person would take away from a situation. Very often, the words are something like, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to break your arm, I'm going to bust your face so that no one will recognize you from now until your dying day. All those things are just words. But they're pretty intimidating, and in circumstances in which the person might carry them out, then you have a real threat of imminent serious bodily harm to you. And so, words can work, even though sometimes we call, for example, mere words not enough, and provocation was a traditional kind of formulation. But here, our standard is what a person of reasonable firmness would yield to. And even a person of reasonable firmness sometimes will yield to words, wouldn't you say? Yeah. Yeah, so let's apply it all to Toscano here. So you're saying, first, is he without blame in bringing about the situation? And he says, you're saying no, because he's dealing with a criminal element.
Yeah, and I mean, they're brothers. I mean, chances are, if he was gambling with the guy, he probably knew about the whole situation, that what was going to result from that, you're going to get involved.
So maybe it's a little bit like being, he's not a member of a gang, but he is associating with maybe very dangerous people. If you can build up that case, and not just from the names here, you'd have to build up the case to show that he is setting himself up for receiving a threat like this. And so maybe we've got a little bit in here, but you can see in building the case against Toscano, from the prosecutor's standpoint, you'd want more facts along that line. What about the rest? Do we have, really, him coerced by a threat of imminent death or serious bodily harm, including the threat to his wife? And I see some people shaking their heads. Why would you say no? Those who are saying no, yeah.
I have a question. Is it imminent death or serious bodily harm, or just imminent go to death and serious bodily harm?
Imminent goes to both. Imminent goes to both.
I don't think he was coerced by a threat because it was so vague.
It was a mushy kind of hint.
It was so vague, and basically, and it was internal to him.
Or you could say that we have a threat here, but we don't know what it's a threat of. So the exact formulation could really matter. Whether you're going to insist on a threat of imminent death or serious bodily harm, or something softer. And what does the Toscano court... They don't require a threat that is quite as specific, not death or serious bodily harm, but just of unlawful force against self or another. Notice when they say unlawful, they're still talking only about threats from a human agent, because rocks aren't unlawful. So it's still the same that way, but they're softening up the specificity here. So you say that under this formulation, maybe it'd be hard to say that there was really a threat of death or serious bodily harm. Just too vague a threat. Would a person of reasonable firmness, quite apart from what is being threatened here, would you give in to this kind of conduct if you're a reasonable person of reasonable firmness?
It depends on Leonardo.
He's you think he's a dangerous kind of guy, all those kinds of facts might really build up the case for the defense. We want a little bit more to be able to resolve this part. And you're not trying to kill anybody anyway, so you're okay on this this final requirement. Let's say, and then let's base our judgment on the generic formulations, in this case of duress, but also the generic formulation of choice of evils. What if I threaten to burn your car right now if you don't steal this casebook? I threaten to burn your car if you don't steal this casebook. If you take the casebook, would you have any defense, either duress or necessity? Why would you not have a defense of duress? Ah, so the threat is a threat to property. Notice that will never work. That'll never work under most formulations of the duress defense. A threat to property is not going to be enough. Even the Toscano, softer formulation, unlawful force against a person. You're not talking about threats to property. Those will never be enough to make out a duress defense. But why not a choice of equals defense? I'll burn your car if you don't take this casebook. And I know the answer. It's because this would the choice of evils
defense, why not?
I'm sorry?
It doesn't involve personalities.
What do you mean when you say that? No, I didn't make a threat personal to you, and that would be required for a choice of evils defense to apply.
You notice I haven't put it up here, but it was up here before. And remember that for choice of evils, you have to reasonably believe that it's necessary to avoid an imminent harm that's greater than the harm of your conduct itself.
Would it have to include a threat to you? Not at all. There doesn't have to be a threat in that case. So maybe, depending on how you value the harms, you might have a claim that it's necessary to avoid an imminent greater harm in this situation. But duress would never work because you have a threat to property and not a threat of death or serious bodily injury, as is most commonly the case.
Well, this may kind of sound kind of silly, but number one, I'd be satisfied if you could choose to go to law school class. Is that not proximate cause enough to be great?
Oh, that you're, is you have a blame in bringing about the situation, because that's why you're sitting here.
Yeah, because you have a cause and fact, and he chose to be in law school, so he's here.
Notice that it's not, the idea is not that but for my choice to go to law school, because in a sense you could say everybody is then blame and bringing about the situation because they always made a choice to be where they were, where this threat occurred. That's not how it's analyzed. Notice, it's without blame in bringing about the situation. It's not a but-for causation or just if there's any causal connection here. It's, is there something that I did that was wrong that leads to this threat? And that combination would be pretty hard to defend, except in an extremely metaphysical way. Yes, sir.
Well, the NPC says harm or evil to himself or to another, so that's a little common law.
I'm sorry?
The NPC for choice of evils is harm to a person. So does it say common law then?
Well, under the model penal code approach to choice of evils you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's not a harm to an individual. That's not how it reads.
It's the harm or evil sought to be avoided by such conduct is greater than that to be prevented by the law defining the offense. So it's not specifying that particular kind of harm. You're just balancing out the harm, and you have to be minimizing the harm to society. Yeah.
Would a person necessarily use one or the other than both? They usually use excessive defense. Does it matter when you have both available?
When you have both available, you may have an overlap. Because after all, often, if you've got a threat of death or serious bodily harm, you might be choosing the lesser of two evils to go along with the threat because of the importance of human life, given what the person is asking you to do. So you could very easily have both defenses. You can raise both defenses. Tactically, you'd have to figure out whether you want to focus the jury's attention in one way or another so that it fits your theory a little bit better. But you can certainly raise both of those defenses, ask for an instruction on both when the facts support it. Let's think all the way back again. So I'm encouraging you to do that a little bit at this time of the semester. What about the Regina B. Dudley and Stephen situation? Cannibalism on the high seas situation. Might they have either a duress or a choice of evils defense? I mean, we know how the case itself came out, but if you were applying the generic formulation, what would you say?
I would say they had a choice of evils.
Yeah.
That it was either one person died or they all died. It's less evil that one person should die rather than they all die.
And any argument that you wouldn't have a successful choice of evils in the Regina B. Dudley and Stevens?
They committed intentional homicide.
They did. And that was critical in Regina B. Dudley and Stevens itself, so it wouldn't amount to a defense. What about under modern formulations? That was a traditional part of the necessity defense. That's what we saw in Regina B. Dudley and Stevens. But if you look at the model penal code formulation or our generic formulation, what do you find? So there's that problem too. Is it really likely, is it necessary to avoid the harm in this situation when they may have had a ship coming over the horizon at any moment? What about the point about the intentional homicide? Under our, yeah.
Well, like how it used to be limited to natural things. But
yeah.
That's also just inherent to the intentional homicide.
Yeah. So traditionally you had that as a part of the necessity defense. It's not a part of the choice of evils defense under the model penal code and under most modern formulations of choice of evils. If you're in fact losing one life, but gaining three, if under the circumstances, why then you might have a favorable choice of evils, and you might be able to have a defense. How about a defense of duress in the Dudley and Stephen situation, the cannibalism on the high seas? Keeping your voice up for everyone. Yeah, so here we have to have a threat from another, and the threat comes from the high seas and natural sources in Dudley and Stevens. So that means that we wouldn't have a duress defense because the threat has to come from a human agency. Let's say you're facing... Yes, ma'am. In cases in which you don't have a reasonable belief, which defense are you talking about? Yes. And that's a variation that here is not a complete defense. Under that formulation, this is unusual, but it's one approach. It functions as a mitigation, just like a provocation formula. So we've seen a couple of ways in which jurisdictions will do something like a provocation formula. Imperfect self-defense is one kind of situation. In a jurisdiction that doesn't allow the defense as a complete defense, in the case of duress, as a complete defense to intentional homicide, why it might function as a mitigation. That's what we see in New Jersey. And then otherwise it's treated like the provocation formula, a partial defense rather than a complete defense. What we've been talking about in connection with both of these defenses is when they function as complete defenses. And most jurisdictions don't do that variation, that working out a partial defense when it comes to this last element. Yes, sir?
To clarify, so any jurisdiction that doesn't allow murder under the duress defense would allow it as a provocation?
No. It would usually not function as a defense at all to intentional homicide. Doesn't function as a complete defense, usually doesn't function as a partial defense. One solution that's accommodating the concerns here, say, well, you shouldn't kill anybody, but we can kind of understand it. So they regarded it as the sound of one hand clapping, as in the case of the provocation formula. And so it kind of makes sense to treat it as a partial defense in this case where it won't be a complete defense, but that's unusual. In fact, that's the only example of which I'm aware in which it's done that way. One quick last example. What if you're facing advancing floodwaters threatening to destroy your home? The one and only way to save your home is to construct a barrier that diverts the water. Now, you know, when you construct a barrier to divert the floodwaters, it will destroy your neighbor's home. This is a tract development, and these homes are absolutely identical. So it will destroy your neighbor's identical, equally valued home instead. Duress defense? Duress defense if you divert the floodwaters?
Probably no.
Not just probably. You can say absolutely no duress defense. Why? Yeah. Because here it's a threat to your property rather than your life. What about a choice of evils defense? By hypothesis, the harms are equal, so you don't have a favorable choice of evils, no defense at all, even though maybe a person of reasonable firmness would do this. And so is this person really, really blameworthy? But here we have a natural peril. Direct defense doesn't function against natural peril, only against threats from human sources. So, here, a little bit more than normal, we have some sort of technical lines that are drawn, separating out appropriate defense in one direction or another direction, sometimes cutting it off altogether because of a little bit of a reluctance, probably, about the potential overuse of these kinds of defenses. Next time, we'll come back and look at insanity as an excuse, having moved then fully from justification to excuse among cross-cutting defenses. And our last class will be Tuesday. And remember, even though it's Tuesday, it's scheduled as a one-hour class, isn't it? Because technically, I believe... Oh, that's right. I'm glad you said that. It's Monday, and it's a one-hour class because it's technically the Thursday.
But it's still the same time.
Administrative Thursday. So we'll meet on Monday. Same time, same bat channel, same everything. Number 5. Right. Because if you kill that person, then you
first you haven't minimized harm, and secondly, even though a person of reasonable firmness might go ahead and succumb to that risk, the law insists that you not, because that's such a serious crime.
And if
well, that might be a threat of bodily harm to another in that situation. So you look at it situationally, if it functions as a threat. And you look at it and how it functions as to you. Let's say they think your house is empty, but you know that there are people there. Probably be evaluated according to what you know, because that's what they're really talking about, what a person of reasonable firmness would do in your situation. Good question. Yeah.
I have a question about for the state of same law, there's three involved in the good acceptance, right?
Yeah.
And for people being Marrero, is that a contradiction to the model penal code formulation?
Yes, it's not really a contradiction to the model penal code formulation. In Marrero, that was the possession
officer
of the officer.
Whether or not the firearm, and he thought that he was an officer of the peace, but
yeah,
he wasn't under the.
Yeah, and it was just a situation in which you had no defense because they concluded that there was no reasonable reliance on an official statement of law, which is the model penal code
right,
standard.
That's what
they're
I
just
thought
saying
maybe
it didn't apply here.
They're saying it wasn't reasonable.
They're saying it wasn't reasonable because even though it's kind of a hard case, because peace officer had that exception when he worked for an institution, but it's actually consistent. It's just that they're applying that standard in murder.
I had a felony murder question.
Mm-hmm.
Does
don't do it. Don't do it. I'm telling you.
Does robbery? I had a real problem with this. Does robbery merge? It's assault plus larceny. Someone dies while you're doing assault.
It doesn't merge because you have an independent
from taking the money.
Right. And that's the tricky part, because there are a lot of crimes that have assaultive elements. Mm-hmm. Rape has assaultive elements. Robbery has assaultive elements. And you think, well, doesn't that merge because felonious assault merges? And the answer is no, because they have an independent felonious purpose. So you ask yourself whether there's a felonious purpose that's independent of the very assault that produces the death. And if there is, then it's a suitable predicate felony as far as that limitation goes.
Even if there's assault involved.
Even if there's assault involved. That's the tricky part.
Even if the assault produces the death?
Well, let's say you have a robbery. I'm trying to think of a good example where the assault does produce the death. Robbery, force, and violence. And the guy, pistol whips the person. And he died. And the purpose in pistol whipping him was the robbery. You'd still have an independent felonious purpose associated with that felony. He's using an assault as part of that purpose to get money. He doesn't really want to just damage the person. He doesn't really just want to kill him. And so you have a separate independent felonious purpose. So that robbery, even though, and the person could die of a heart attack in the course of the robbery. And you can still separate out the felonious purpose of the robbery from the felonious purpose of somebody who just wants to bap you in the, let's say the only thing, it wasn't a robbery. I just can't stand you and I take the pistol and smack it across your head and you die. Well, then we do have a merger. I mean, it might still be murder under the circumstances,
right.
But it's not going to be felony murder because that's the assault. It might be a felonious assault. And it's that assault that produces your death, and I don't have any additional felonious purpose that is causing me to engage in that assaultive activity.
And does
and rape would be the same way. You might have somebody strangling, holding somebody down, and they die during the course of the rape.
Right.
You're still an independent felonious purpose.
Does arson have an independent? It depends on the circumstances.
Arson's a little closer because you might be burning the house down to kill somebody. But in general, if it's an insurance, you'd have an independent felonious purpose.
All right. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
You have intent of larceny, and sometimes it's the
focus is assault, right?
Right.
And in that case, do we have to look for the purpose of the act or...
In that case, at least in California, they've separated burglaries into two parts. They said, well, it doesn't make sense to have something that happens in the home and be any different than if it happens out on the street. So the burglary with intent to commit a felonious assault inside in California has been treated as something that would merge, whereas the burglary with the intent to commit larceny would have an independent felonious purpose. There's a little dispute about that, whether you should subdivide burglary, but at least there is some precedent for doing that, so that you have murder of some burglary and not murder of other.
Now, what about, what does model penal code say about
that? The model penal code does not have, strictly speaking, a felony murder rule. It has a felony murder presumption that's treated, it's absorbed into the category of what we've been calling extremely reckless homicide. That you have a rebuttable presumption that when you're engaged in certain felonious acts, then it's extremely reckless as to the result of death. So strictly speaking, under the model penal code, you don't have a felony murder rule.
Okay. And one more question. Is this the model penal code approach?
No. This is different from the model penal code approach. What I've done is to, because the I try to give you the things that are most helpful in terms of most jurisdictions. And here we have a little bit more variation than usual among jurisdictions. So I've tried to give you a generic formulation that is the most typical formulation that we see in jurisdictions, each of them. The choice of evils formulation and the duress formulation are different from the model.
So are we going to tell that this is generic jurisdiction format, or whether this is...
You'll be told in what terms to answer the question. So I could, for example, have you apply the model penal code. And as to ones that we hadn't studied closely, you'd have to break it down. I could ask you to apply the most common or generic formulations of these defenses. And I'd expect you to be able to do that because that's the way we treated it here in class. Or I could give you a separate statute that varied the requirements a little bit.
But if we talk about the model penal code, we need to bring it in ourselves. You're not to supply it.
You would, and so I'm suggesting that you go ahead and bring the textbook, because you'll have the model penal code as the part of the appendix. So you can bring in whatever you like, and I suggest you do bring in the casebook.
I do have one question I know that was asked and answered in class, but I was counseling the girl next to me through a crisis because she checked her boyfriend's email during a class, and I couldn't really escape the aftermath of that. Let's just say right now she may need to hire you. She's on her way to his house now.
I don't want to know.
So,
I hope your counseling was good. That's all I can say, and I don't want to know anything more.
Let's just say she didn't pass out. I was able to get her to breathe, so that was the beginning, so you wouldn't have to worry about...
You know, probably in any room with this number of people at any time, there's great drama going on in someone's life.
The problem is that the past couple of classes, they installed the internet, so... I mean, until this past month...
You guys haven't been getting the internet here?
Until this past month, maybe, there's been no internet, but they recently installed that thing up on the...
So there's a little bit more surfing and email opportunities.
The girl that got the You've Got Mail thing that you heard, that was her checking...
Okay, that was the You've Got Mail, okay.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the end. Let's leave it at that. So, when you went over the necessity defense, it mentioned must show face with choice of evils and chose a lesser evil. And that got me confused on when you... I know necessity defense and choice of evils are two different things.
Actually, they're the same thing. They're two different names for the same thing.
Oh, because the way we had gone over them, it seemed like some of the...
Some of the historic things have dropped away, and... It is an older term to use necessity and choice of evils. But the necessity defense in concept was a choice of evils defense. So it's really two different titles for the same basic idea.
Okay, because I know last class you'd gone over the elements of choice of evils and...
Oh, let me stop.